Well, we're going to pick up kind of where we left off last, Sunday, in our last class. We were looking at the very end of chapter 4 and the beginning of chapter 5. But just want to kind of review a couple of things. We spoke about the 12 stones. These 12 stones that were referenced in chapter 4, and we looked at and recognized that it is talking about, we have two different sets of 12 stones that are being referred to in this chapter, and also what those stones represent as far as one stone for each tribe. And we noted that with one set of the stones, because it mentioned, I believe, verse 3, it says, carry them over with you and lay them down in the lodging place where you will lodge tonight. So we see that idea of where they were lodging. We know that they were lodging in Gilgal. And also in verse 20, it says that they took the 12 stones they had taken from the Jordan, and Joshua set up at Gilgal. So we see that we had 12 that were set up at Gilgal. And then we also mentioned about the 12 that were in the middle or midst of the Jordan. But remember some of the comments that were brought up about that, this idea of the term can be midst. It's not necessarily in the center. Keep in mind this was something that was going to be able to be seen. So it would make sense that it could be at the edge. But regardless where it is, we also looked at the idea that what is taking place in order to do these things. I mean, let's not forget how this water is being separated, and that there's a dry path, and what is being done to be able to do these things. So we recognize the power that God has. And one thing I did want to mention that I didn't mention in class about this, you know, just like I said, regardless of where it is, let's remember what it's saying here. It was evident in this time, because we have some phrases that are being used throughout this book that references to this day. So we see these type of phrases, and wherever it was something that could be seen till that day. So it was evident. So let's remember that. And then not only was it evident to them, we can read it. So we can read about it. So let's just consider those things. So we'll go ahead, and unless there's any more comments or thoughts on that, that someone... Yes, sir, Craig.
Chapter 4, verse 24, also that all the people of the earth may know that the hand of the Lord is mighty. No doubt there was evidence that the people of the land of Canaan knew about the God of Israel.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, that's a good point, because we'll see that over and over, this idea of people hearing or seeing things, and it is evident. And that was kind of the next point that I was building up to on 4:24 and 5:1, the way they're kind of linked. Because when you look at chapter 5, you have this one verse that doesn't seem to fit. Let's remember, this is other people or men putting the division here. I think that 4:24 and 5:1 kind of have something to go together there. And we've seen those types of things before. When you're building on a point in a verse, it might actually start from the last verse of the previous chapter. So in 4:24, like Craig said, we'll go ahead and read it. said that all the peoples of the earth may know that the hand of the Lord is mighty, so that you may fear the Lord your God forever. And then we go into 5:1, and it says, now it came about when all the kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan to the west, and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea, heard how the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan before the sons of Israel until they had crossed, that their hearts, so they dried up this until it had crossed, and their hearts melted, and there was no spirit in them any longer because of the sons of Israel. So this idea of the fear that has come upon them, they recognize the might and the power of this God, and they know that this God is with the sons of Israel. So fear comes upon them. And then after verse 1, then it goes into a whole different thought. So I coupled 4:24 and 5:1 together, and then we'll look at 5:2 all the way to, well, actually 12. Because we've got this, no, 9, we'll split it up in three ways. But, so is there any comment or thoughts on 4:24 to 5:1? I mean, it's a short little section, not a whole lot in that section, but it does tell us some things. Okay, well then we'll move on. So, let's talk about in chapter 5, verses 2 through 9 then. Verses 2 through 9. Now, I posed the question, why did the sons of Israel need to be circumcised a second time? Now, the reason why I said it that way, verse 2 says, at that time, the Lord said to Joshua, make for yourselves flint knives and circumcise again the sons of Israel the second time. So, was it really a second time? Okay. And what I mean by that is there a second circumcision that is taking place? Answer is no. Well, I saw some no's, but yeah, I know I didn't word it very well on there, but my thought on that is, and it explains more too as it goes on, but that's how it says it in verse 2. You know, it says that it's their circumcision again, the second time. But let's jump down to verse 5. Verse 5 states that all the men that came out of Egypt were circumcised. So, those men that already came out of Egypt, they were circumcised. Why does this no longer have any significance?
It tells in verse 4 why they were circumcised.
Okay. And it is?
The group that came out of Egypt died in the wilderness.
Yeah, except for 2. Yes, ma'am. So then that's what it's saying here. I mean, technically, yeah, second circumcision, but it wasn't the second circumcision to this group, from what I'm understanding. So you see here in verse 5, for all the people who came out were circumcised, but all the people who were born in the wilderness along the way as they came out of Egypt had not been circumcised. And then, as Sally pointed out in verse 4, it says, and this is the reason why Joshua circumcised them. All the people who came out of Egypt, who were males, all the men of war, died in the wilderness along the way after they came out of Egypt. So that was the need. That was the reason why they were to be circumcised again. So it's just the way that it starts off wording it, but it goes in and it explains some things. So it wasn't necessarily that the people that had been circumcised were circumcised again, but it was a second one. So did that make any sense? Okay. Any thoughts or comments or questions or nothing? Got nothing? Okay. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. So, because they, that's right. So, they died in the wilderness because they weren't obedient. That is correct. So, what is the significance of circumcision? Listed on there, we can go to Genesis 17. We'll read Genesis 17, 9 and following, well, through 14.
I just want to once get to that.
Okay.
So here you've got a nation, maybe 2 million people across the Jordan River. You've got women, children, overband, and you've got your soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
So they're advancing into Canaan. They've heard what's happened. The people in that land have heard what happened to the kings before them, how they were coming to take the land and conquering the kings. But now all the soldiers are circumcised. Now's the time to attack. However, you'll note in verse 1, maybe that's the reason that's there, I don't know. They heard about them crossing the Jordan River on dry land, everybody's scared to death.
Bought some time, huh?
There's a heart and element in there. And so they heard about it, just another miracle. And of course, there are those who try to dismiss the crossing of the Jordan as just an earthquake, and after a sample, that wouldn't cause their hearts to melt. It's an earthquake, they got crossed. But the nature of it, if 2 million people could cross on dry land with their animals, tents, everything else, is quite astounding. What kind of God did these people have?
Yes, sir. Yeah, that's a good point, Steve. And I didn't even think about it, what you were mentioning, that, yeah, while this is taking place, they would kind of be at a disadvantage.
Well, that's what Simeon Levi did to the Shechemites.
Yeah, yeah, I didn't even think of that.
If you want to attack them at their most vulnerable time, this would be it.
That's a good point.
Craig?
Yes, sir.
About circumcision, that was something that began around the time of Abraham. When I saw that they hadn't been getting circumcised throughout these children being born after they'd left Egypt, I was surprised because I figured that they were maintaining that 8 days old. Getting circumcised, kind of the idea that had come up with Abraham. I don't know why they weren't getting circumcised, but they just apparently weren't.
Right, during the time of the wilderness, I don't know, but it's evident that they weren't from what we're reading here.
They just come out of Egypt. They've been surrounded by idolatry for 200 to 400 years, and evidently were not obeying God.
Right, so they haven't got back in
the. When they came out of Egypt, they weren't circumcised. Because they had no prophet, no leader for several hundred years.
That helped, Josh?
Okay, so it sounds like they weren't being circumcised because that was part of their not observing all that God intended for them to, be observing. Not only were they not being faithful, but making mistakes in the wilderness, one of those would have been they also weren't following the instructions given to Abraham, which were the 8 days old child male is to be circumcised. I'm just trying to understand circumcision. Were they not following a understood, instruction for them to circumcise their 8 days old child while they were in the wilderness? Or was that kind of postponed? It sounds like they were just not following it in that.
Because of the influencers or other.
Brought them back to, hey, this is instruction for us.
Well, all the ones who came out, verse 5 says all the ones who came out were circumcised. They may have been coming out of idolatry, but it does say in verse 5, for all the people who came out were circumcised, but all the people who were born in the wilderness along the way as they came out of Egypt had not been circumcised.
Right.
So maybe it was some, I don't know why it would have stopped.
That's kind of what I think Josh was asking, but all I can say, I don't know for certain. As far as me, we do know from the verses, like we're looking at and what we're bringing up, that evidently they weren't. And so at this time, that's being resolved. So let's look at Genesis 17. And this is just going over some of the purpose of it. In Genesis 17, verse 9, God said further to Abraham, "Now as for you, you shall keep my covenant, and you and your descendants after you throughout their generations. This is my covenant, which you shall keep between me and you and your descendants after you. Every male among you shall be circumcised, and you shall be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskin, and it shall be the sign of the covenant between me and you. And every male among you who is 8 days old shall be circumcised throughout your generations. A servant who is born in the house or who is bought with money from any foreigner who is not of your descendants, a servant who is born in your house, or who is bought with your money, shall surely be circumcised. Thus shall my covenant be in your flesh for an everlasting covenant. But an uncircumcised male who is not circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin, that person shall be cut off from his people, and he has broken my covenant." So whatever it is, we see here that there's a need for the circumcision, and that is what is being addressed at this point. So they renew this covenant, this relationship with God through this circumcision. Yes, sir, Craig?
I think there's a significance in Joshua here as well, because in the old law, the thing you read about circumcision is that they had a stranger or a slave. They were to take and circumcise them. They shouldn't partake of Passover unless they had taken and circumcised them. And here, at the end of this, we see
what they're building, what they're building up to.
It's almost like a renewing of that commitment that the people, the relationship, like you said, with the covenant,
right,
the relationship they have with God, and how God has restored them.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yeah. So we see that's what they're doing. They're renewing this covenant relationship with God. Yes, sir, Ronnie?
Well, this, I don't know whether it's the first example, but it is one of the many examples in the Old Testament where the children of Israel had to reconsecrate themselves to forgotten the law. I remember, I think it was in the reign of Josiah, he discovered the book of the law and discovered they hadn't kept the Passover in however many years, you know. Things like that. As the children began to fall away, whether it's under the bad kings or between the judges or whatever, they would not do certain things. When it came time for something important to happen, a great battle or whatever, they would have to go and reconsecrate themselves. And this is one of those examples.
Okay. Anybody else? Okay, I also put on there Galatians, some New Testament. And the reason behind that was, of course, it's not talking about what we're talking about, our subject. But just for us to think about, we already know, but it's just a good thing to bring up. Circumcision in this point is no longer important, not for us. Circumcision is not a sign of the relationship with God under the new covenant. The the covenant relationship is established and being maintained by this new creation, or through the cross of Jesus. And then we are, by our faith, we're walking in under His rule. We're following Him. And that's just a point I put in Galatians 5:1-6, where, you know, Paul was talking about a circumcision, and also in 6:14-16. So we would just, in Galatians 5:6, we'll just read that part. It says, "For in Christ Jesus, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision means anything, but faith working through love." So this idea of faith in Christ, that is what we are to have, although they were to show circumcision as a sign. That is not part of what we do as a sign of our relationship. That's the only reason why I put that on there. If we look at the next section, section or verses 10 through 12. You know, this is talking about the Passover. And like Craig mentioned, they're building up to start to observe this again. And in Exodus 12, well, on your lesson, I think I only put 2 through 3, but you might add on there verse 6 as well. We'll go over to Exodus 12:2. I noticed that on my notes today. So Exodus 12:2, it says, "This month shall be the beginning of months for you. It is to be the first month of the year to you. Speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying, on the 10th of this month, they are each one to take a lamb for themselves, according to the father's household, a lamb for each household." And then when you go down to verse 6, it has more explanation. It says, "And you shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month. Then the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel is to kill it at twilight." So we see some time references. We see the 10th day, and we see the 14th day. And verse 6, well, we just saw it. Verse 6 of Exodus, "You will kill it at twilight." If we go back to Joshua, we know that when they crossed the Jordan, that they were camped at Gilgal. And then we can go back a chapter, 4:19. We kind of already looked at this, I believe. We mentioned it starting off our class. The idea of them being camped at Gilgal. Well, I think that was verse 3, though. In verse 19, it says, "Now the people came up from the Jordan on the 10th of the first month." So again, we see a time reference here. So it's on the 10th of the first month and camped at Gilgal on the east edge of Jericho. And that is the day that they are to take this lamb. Now in Joshua back in 5, in verse 10, where we're starting this new section, it says, "While the sons of Israel camped at Gilgal, they observed the Passover on the evening of the 14th day of the month on the desert plains of Jericho." So we see that's another one of our time references. So Passover was on the 14th day. And we see that observed here in Joshua 5:10. And there's other verses you can look at. Actually, there's a bunch of verses that you can look at to build up some time references. But I think that some of these are enough just to kind of make our point. And that's this. The sons of Israel observed the first Passover in Canaan. From what I can understand and tell, this was on the 41st year after them leaving Egypt. Because we know they had 40 years in the wilderness. If we look over at Deuteronomy 1:3. Let's look at Deuteronomy 1:3. Now, when Moses preached his sermon in Moab, Deuteronomy 1:3 says that it was the 40th year. And on the first day of the 11th month. And then if you go over to the end of the chapter, in Deuteronomy 34, I believe it's verse 8. Verse 8 says, this was after his death, it says that the sons of Israel wept for 30 days. So we know that Joshua 4:19 was referring to the 10th day of the first month on the 41st year that they left Egypt. And that's just by kind of figuring out some of these time references. We know that this was the first time after those 40 years. So that's kind of what I'm coming up with, that it's this is the first day of the month, and it's representing that 41st year after they left Egypt. Any questions or thoughts or added comments? Or okay. So, when did manna cease? And the other two verses in the small section we were looking at in Joshua 5. Let's go back over there. So the Passover was the 14th. And verse 11 says that they ate some produce of the land on the day after the Passover. So Passover is the 14th. They eat the produce of the land the 15th. And then verse 12 says that the manna ceased on the day after eating the produce of the land. So the following day would be the 16th. So that morning of the 16th, there's no more manna. Because we know the Passover is observed in the evening, and we know that manna took place in the morning, or came in the morning. So basically, on the 16th of that month, there was no more manna. And we can kind of date it based on just the little bit of information that it gave us in there. Any thoughts? Or yes, sir, Craig.
During the wanderings, there was complaints about the man and how it was the potential. Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 10, it shall come about when the Lord your God brings you into the land which he swore to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you, great and splendid cities which you did not build, and houses full of all good things which you did not fill, and huge cisterns which you did not dig, vineyards and olive trees which you did not plant, and you eat and are satisfied. Then watch yourselves that you do not forget the Lord your God who brought you from the land of Egypt.
fear only in the Lord your God, but to worship him and to love his name. And so, you know, here's a day that they no longer have to eat this manna, and they're eating produce of the land, you know, maybe from as they go into the land and conquer it, there's going to be vineyards and stuff set up, stuff that's going to be done, and they're going to remember that came from the Lord. So the Lord has always provided for us.
So we see provisions here. Okay.
These are like very momentous occasions, the healing from the circumcision, and so the reproach of Egypt is taken away, the observance of the Passover, the ceasing of the manna, and now they're taking the photos. And, you know, also all the folks who have, all the men who left Egypt have perished now. So this is a major turning over for, you know, Abraham's descendants, the Israelite people. They're taking on a new, taking on a new chapter. So that you know, like Uncle for Ryan said, this is a major step towards their unity with God. They're moving forward and marching onward with God.
Yes. Yes, and then building on these things, we come to the last little verses in this section here. And before we even look at it, I'm going to tell you this person we're talking about. I don't know for certain. There's some things I'm going to bring up. There's two views on it that we're going to look at for you to consider. But because of some of the things that are mentioned in here, I'm certain, and again, you'll have to read it for yourself, but I'm certain that whoever this is, it's one of the Godhead. And we'll see, I'll explain as we look over some of that why I think that. Now, I did separate this as its own little part. We'll see going into 6:1, we'll see some things talking about the Lord. But one of my thought process on this is that this might be two different people of the Godhead. So let's just take a look at it. In Joshua 5, verses 13 through 15, it talks about this captain of the army, and I know different versions use different wordage, but mine use it as the captain of the host of the Lord. And I put on here, I said, who is this? Who is this captain of the host of the Lord? One point we could consider, but it doesn't, in itself, doesn't necessarily mean anything. But here it appears that this captain is the host, or they are over the host of the Lord. So we see them almost as references, could be referenced as two different beings, or it could be as one. Depends on how you think of the wordage. But again, I don't know for certain which of the Godhead it is referring to. I have one that I'm kind of leaning to, and I'll explain that as I go. But there's definitely some things that we can consider in this short little part. So note how this starts out. You have Joshua, and this is when he's near Jericho. So what is it that's about to take place in Jericho? What's going to happen? What are they there for? To take over Jericho. Okay. Right. So they're there for battle. And so Joshua, he sees this man standing there. And that's to me a picture or a thought of battle. This man standing there with his sword drawn. So this man is ready. He's ready for battle. And Joshua asked him, he said, "Are you with us or our adversary?" So basically he's saying, "Hey, are you with us or are you against us?" And note how this man replies. He says, "No, rather I indeed came now as captain of the host of the Lord." So whoever he is claiming to be, note how Joshua reacts in verse 14. Joshua fell on his face to the earth and he bowed down. In verse 15, what is he claiming? This man tells Joshua to remove his sandals because the place where he is standing is holy. So question, does that mean because of that spot of land right there by Jericho is holy, or is that standing for because of the place of where he is, who he's standing before? So that is what he's trying to say. It's not the spot where he was standing. It was who he was standing before. The person he was standing before was holy. So whoever this is, I believe it's one of the Godhead. Now, I put on your notes, you can compare the term captain in other versions. And some versions use captain, some use commander. So still this idea of leader of warfare. But the American Standard and the Young's Literal Translation uses the term prince. So this term prince is being used in two of the versions. That itself doesn't prove anything, but it's still something that we should weigh and we can keep in the back of our head. So we need to consider that. Could this be talking about God the Son? I don't think it's the same person it's talking about when it transitions into 6:1, just because of some of the way that it is worded. And 6:1 is basically worded like 1:1. So I tend to think the way this was brought up, being sectioned here, it's possibly a different person. So, whoever he is, this captain, what it states is who he's over. Okay? Which he is the leader of. It says that he's the leader of the Lord's host. Or that term can also be army. Or that term host can also mean people or Israel. So we see these different meanings that the word host can be used for. Let's look at Exodus 12:41 just to bring out some of that point. Exodus 12:41. And this is just to help on the terminology of not the person, but of the word hosts, who he is claiming to be leader of. So in 12:41, it says hosts of the Lord. Talking about people that all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. And then if you go down to verse 51, It came about on the same day that the Lord brought the sons of Israel out of the land of Egypt. So here, host is sons of Israel. Exodus 7:4. We see this. That's why that doesn't look right. Exodus 7:4. Talking about bringing them out. Bringing them out of Egypt. The Lord says, my hosts, my people, the sons of Israel. So just for us to think about. So this person, this captain, or prince of the host, or that is, this captain or prince of the sons of Israel, the Lord's people. So, just a thought, could it be referring to God the Son? It's possible. Can't prove it. Just a thought. Again, by what was said in verse 15, it's definitely one of the Godhead. Another option. Look at Exodus 3. I have to look at this kind of quick. I'm running out of time. So Exodus 3, 1 through 6. You know, it was talking about the burning bush, different occasion. But we see some similarities in some of the words. But the difference in this case, in verse 2, it says, you know, the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire. So who is this? But then at least when you go further down, we see in verse 6 that it explains that I'm the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. We don't have that kind of explanation in Joshua. Again, that doesn't prove anything. That doesn't prove that Joshua isn't this same Godhead. These are just things for us to consider. It's definitely talking about one of the Godhead. Which one is it? I don't know. But I've given you some things you can look at and consider. So, that being said, I think we're getting buzzed. Thank you for your attention and your comments.